From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, we'll catch up with some of the top stories in local news with the editor of the Sacramento Press. Also, acclaimed Mexican folkloric dancer Stephen Valencia and folk country Celtic guitarist Kathy Barwick with her new album, In My Life. But first, should California cities have the right to opt out of the controversial Secure Communities deportation program? Critics say it undermines relations between immigrants and local police agencies. A California assemblyman has written a bill that would make participation in Secure Communities optional. We'll talk with him about that. He's Tom Amiano, a Democrat from San Francisco. Assemblyman, thanks for joining us today.
I just heard some wordplay, insecurities.
Okay, I'll leave that to you for your opinion. But the title is Secure Communities. Can you first of all let us know what that is? What does it involve?
Well, the way it's spun by the immigration people here, it's supposed to make things safer. I guess that's the simplest thing. The ICE program states that the mission of ESCOM is to target serious offenders. But in California, 7 out of 10 people deported under ESCOM had no convictions or were accused only of minor offenses. And in my opinion, ESCOM is more of a dragnet that unfairly impacts innocent people and doesn't really accomplish what it touts. And, you know, I do think that given the budget situation, not only for our local enforcement people, because this costs us money, people need to sometimes in the federal government create a need for their services so they don't get cut. And I think that part of the ESCOM inception was definitely based on that as well.
We're talking about Secure Communities. It's a federal program done in collaboration with state and local law enforcement agencies. And basically, in brief, how it works is that when a local law enforcement agency makes an arrest, it typically runs a suspect's name through a national database to check if that person is wanted for another crime or in another jurisdiction. And under Secure Communities, they can also check that person's immigration status. And my guest, Tom Amiano, state assemblyman, would make that that program, the participation in the program, voluntary or optional, rather.
Yes.
What do local law enforcement agencies say to you?
I mean, well, a lot of them are very supportive. You know, we have, and we're working with the sheriffs in the state right now. They would like to see some amendments in the bill. And Sheriff Michael Hennessy of San Francisco came up and testified. I think they feel that it's a drain on resources. And, you know, if there is a flawed design here because the transmission of fingerprints occur at arrest prior to any court proceedings regarding the offense. So the person could be innocent, even with the sharing of fingerprints. And in that case, sometimes people are put on what they call detainee status, and that means they are hosted, so to speak, by that county. So that there's a lot of administrative cost and cost of providing bed space, food, and medical care. I think basically what I'm saying is that ESCOM, and by the way, Illinois just said that they would not honor ESCOM. ESCOM has a very deleterious side effect, which is violation of civil rights.
What do you mean? How does it violate civil rights? I mean, the person's being arrested.
Well, because people are caught up in sweeps, and then they're found innocent of any crime. They were just in the area. But it's too late for them, and I don't, you know, I would honor any local community. But I'm saying is that rather than automatically be an ESCOM, local communities should opt into it. And by opting into it, they get to tailor the program to their needs. Right now, in California, we have a boilerplate agreement with ESCOM that doesn't, Southern California is different than Northern California. San Francisco is different than the Central Valley. And if a community does want to opt into it, then at least you would have specifics that would meet that community's needs. And that's a lot better than what's happening now.
Now critics, of course, would say that even if someone was arrested for a crime that they did not commit, but they were found to be in the country illegally, that they have nevertheless committed a crime.
Well, there's 11 million undocumented people in the country right now. That's the latest count. And deporting 11 million of them through ESCOM, I just don't see it happens. And in the meantime, not only are civil rights violated, but there is quite a rupture with people who are undocumented and witness a crime, including people who are undocumented being victims of domestic violence. They're not going to report that crime or cooperate with law enforcement, and they could be valuable regardless of the legality of their status. We just can't keep putting our head in the sand about it. We have to deal with it. And what I'm saying is ESCOM is a very, very poor way to deal with it. It criminalizes you automatically, not just about legal status, but automatically you're criminalized. And I think it's really an overreaction. However, if some county wants it in California, through my bill, they'd be able to opt in.
What does the federal government say about this?
The federal government says that they feel that we cannot opt out of their program. That was a clarification that Janet Napolitano recently made under fire because there's been a lot of criticism of this program. And frankly, with all respect to her, that's a lot of bull hockey. There is no legal basis for ESCOM. They can spin it all they want, but there's no legal basis. So if this bill passes, and of course in Illinois they just opted out, and the federal government wanted to challenge it, then so be it.
The Obama administration has expanded this program, though. Are you prepared for a fight, if necessary, with Washington?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's not unusual here in California. When you look at same-sex marriage and some of the other social justice issues we have, they have to start on a grassroots level. I think the immigrant rights community is finding its voice around this issue. This is a symptomatic issue of not having a comprehensive immigration policy out of Washington. So, before Washington starts expanding things that aren't working, they really need to come up with an overall context, and they have failed to do that. And I'm an Obama fan, but not on this issue. We have to do better.
Assemblyman Tom Ammiano is a Democrat from San Francisco. He's author of a bill that would make participation by local law enforcement agencies in the federal Secure Communities Program, or ESCOM, voluntary. We did, by the way, invite the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency to participate, but they declined. Assemblyman Ammiano, thanks for joining us.
All right. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is Insight. You're listening to Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. And as we do each Tuesday, let's catch up on some of the top stories in local news and arts with the editor of the Sacramento Press, David Watts Barton. Welcome back.
Hi.
Well, let's start with the what seems to be the topic of the week every week in recent weeks, the Kings. And there is something happening today.
Yeah, there's a lot happening, actually. Today, I just drove past it on my way out here, past Plaza that's the old name, Cesar Chavez Plaza at 9th and J. They're setting up, they got the streets blocked off, and they're setting up a stage, and they're going to have a big rally for the Kings, which just happens to coincide with the fact that their season tickets are going on sale today to the general public. But they're going to have Bobby Jackson, Doug Christie, and Scott Pollard there.
Stars from the glory days.
Yeah, as well as head coach Phil Westfall, and hopefully one of the Kings' owners, Gavin Malouf, will actually be there.
I see.
And there's going to be entertainment, which is going to be Tesla.
Oh, the
local rock band.
Legendary Sacramento rock band.
Yeah. So there's a lot going on, and they're doing an interesting thing. I was part of a meeting with a bunch of editors and people from around town with the NBA, because the NBA has come in and is sort of helping the Kings organization really make this season happen. One of the things that they're doing is they started off last Tuesday selling season tickets, and then they're going to be building up for the next month. And if you buy your season tickets in the next month, then they're going to let people go in the order that they bought them and go in and pick their seats in the arena. So they're trying to create a little bit more pressure, the way we had all this pressure by the deadline for them to relocate, and it really motivated the city. And so they're trying to keep that going.
Yeah.
And they've also, as we reported, they've got about 30 new jobs that they've, you know, people hired to sell tickets and things like that. So there is an economic impact already, is the point.
Yeah.
And that's at 5 o'clock, sorry. That's 5
yes,
o'clock today.
And maybe the most famous player from the glory days, Chris Webber, has been weighing in on the issue too, hasn't he?
Yeah, he announced on, he said this a couple times, but he announced it on over the weekend that he's got a group of investors together that are talking about investing in the Kings one way or another, which is another way of sort of putting pressure on the Maloofs. There are still a lot of players in this game.
David Watts-Barton, editor-in-chief of the Sacramento Press. Now, let's talk about taxis. You get a lot of taxis going to and from Power Balance Pavilion. What might be happening with taxis in Sacramento?
Well, they're talking about a couple things. The city council is talking about whether to stop issuing new taxi permits, because the number of taxis has gone up in the last few years, has gone up from 258 taxis to 428 taxis.
Wow.
Which, if you live outside of downtown or the central city, you're probably wondering, there are taxis in Sacramento, right? You don't see taxis in Sacramento. I mean, we all have our own cars, but in the central city, they're used quite a bit, and they've been backing up. You know, they park out in front of the Hyatt, they park out in front of different events, which is great. I mean, people need them. So, but they're talking about limiting the number because it's getting out of control. There's a lot of controversy about it because they're also saying that they want to enforce the cab companies to have central dispatchers, which the big cab company, Yellow, already has. And so some of the smaller cabs are crying foul.
Yeah, I guess it would make it more convenient for the taxi users if there was a central dispatcher, but, you know, maybe less interesting for the company that already has one.
Yeah, potentially, although there are a lot of people downtown who go out regularly and have the cash, have their own cabs, so then they like to be able to call their cab driver or their driver. And some people, I know people who keep a driver sort of on call, and some people share a driver, and so the driver will pick somebody up at one place and take them somewhere else and then pick the other guy up and... Yeah. Like that. So that's going to be over the next few months. That's going to engender quite a bit of discussion on the council.
And speaking of vehicles, taco trucks and the like could be coming to town on a more permanent and stable basis.
Yeah, that possibly. That's another thing. It's probably going to take a lot of time to talk through because there are conflicting interests on that as well. But the whole mobile food festival that we talked about last week, that was such a big success, has spawned several city council members. In fact, five at last count are saying that, yes, we should reconsider this ordinance, and maybe Steve Cohn said we could expand the time that they're allowed to park beyond a half an hour. It would have to be quite a bit beyond a half an hour, I think, for it to work. But there will be a lot of discussion of it. But they're saying that because of the budget cuts, there aren't going to be as many city staff people to work on the report to get information to see how this is going to work. So it could either be we get dragged out without lack of bureaucracy, or it could happen a lot faster because it doesn't go through the bureaucracy.
And you mentioned five city council members. That's a significant number because that would be a majority.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, there's a new restaurant that caught your attention on J Street, not a mobile one.
No, this one will actually stay in the same place, although they'll be serving food that you could get on a mobile truck. And they're called Burgers and Wings, and it's put together by two guys, one of whom Trevor Schultz worked for Randy Perigary for a long time. And it's on that block, the 2800 block of J Street, which is where Centro and Harlow's are, and Red Lotus. And is actually quite a controversial block as well, because the neighborhood association there has been battling with the bars and people coming out late, making noise, littering, doing other things. So there's been a lot of back and forth, and we actually had a long conversation on our site after we posted the story about this restaurant going in.
Oh, yeah.
But you know, hopefully they'll work it out. Maybe not to everybody's satisfaction, but they're going to be serving burgers and 30 different kinds of hot wings.
Well, maybe if people stuff enough burgers and wings in the mouth, it won't make so much noise if they're drunk. What about police? We talked a bit about police in Sacramento, possible layoffs last week. It's looking like perhaps moving closer to that.
Yeah, and when they say we're cutting into muscle now, we literally are cutting into muscle on the budget. Everything that could be cut has been cut. At least that's what we're told. And they're looking at the police, and the police have already lost a lot of positions. So we're down quite a few police already, and they're going to be cutting as many as another 80 sworn officers. So those are people out actually on the beat. And then we're talking about another 86 positions within the department. So it's a really big cuts.
No doubt. David Watts Barton is editor-in-chief of the Sacramento Press. He joins us each Tuesday. We talk about some of the more interesting stories in local news and arts, entertainment, and culture. Now, a former, well, not city manager, but interim city manager has moved on to, I don't know about greener pastures, but more oceanic.
Yeah. I imagine it's greener as well. Gus Vina, who was the interim city manager and was assistant city manager for about a decade before that, and then came in and was actually the person who put this new budget together under a lot of duress and got a vote of no confidence or less than stellar confidence, which a lot of people didn't agree with, but that's the city council. They're the hire and fire of the city manager. So he saw the writing on the wall and decided to take another job and got a job in Encinitas down in San Diego County, I guess.
I happen to be familiar with Encinitas. It's a very nice place, but a lot smaller than Sacramento.
Yeah, and they don't have a budget deficit. So I think that he's probably going to be perfectly happy down there, although he did want to stay and work in Sacramento. He's been very a devoted public servant in Sacramento, so it's a big loss for the city to not have him. But it sounds like he's going to have a lot of fun. And my reporter actually asked him if he's going to learn how to surf, and he wasn't too sure about that.
Speaking of budget deficits, the Sacramento Opera has a budget deficit, but it's getting closer to eliminating it, isn't it?
Yeah, they started out about a month ago, saying that they needed $122,000. By May 26th, I believe, and they're down to, they need $14,000.
That's so that they can have another season.
So they can have another season. They've already canceled two shows this season just to try to make the budget work. And they put the call out, and a lot of people have ponied up more than $100,000. So it looks as though they may make that money back. They need to restructure their organization, though, and they need to find angels who are going to give them money on a more regular basis, because they've tried to run the opera mostly on ticket sales, and when ticket sales go down, it all falls apart. So they need a bit of a buffer. So presumably this is going to buy them some time to figure that out.
Well, there's a very different kind of music featured in Sacramento this week, and seems to be doing quite well, albeit on a much smaller scale than opera, in the flow.
Yeah, that's going to be coming up this weekend, starting on Thursday. It's Ross Hammonds, our frequent guest on Inside, as
yeah,
I recall.
Yeah, and in fact, he's going to be on tomorrow. We're going to talk about In the Flow tomorrow, but this is something that's crossed your radar, too.
Yes, and this is the fourth year, and they moved it over to Beatnik Gallery off of Broadway the last couple of years, but now they're going to be back in Midtown at different venues around the central city, and so you'd be able to walk from venue to venue, and I think it'll be fun, and he can tell you all about what those venues are tomorrow, but it's going to be like around Antiquité and Phono Select, the new record store run by one of the guys who used to work at R15 for Tower.
Yeah, and it's kind of an esoteric form of music, but nevertheless, it seems to be doing quite well, albeit in a relatively small scale way. But In the Flow has grown and is building a name for itself outside of Sacramento, apparently.
Yeah, and it draws people from L.A., from San Francisco, musicians, a couple people from New York. So it's a going concern. It's great.
And one last topic involving Pixar.
Yeah, Pixar, they're doing a tour of some of the artifacts from their first 11 films.
Some of the most famous animated films of recent years.
Absolutely.
Toy Story and so on.
Yeah, Bug's Life, going all the way back. And this is going to be the first stop, and it's going to be at the California Railroad Museum and Stage 9, which is a place downtown that does a lot of movie memorabilia. So they're going to be bringing it through. I don't know how long it's going to be here, actually. But it starts on Sunday.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
David Watts Barton, editor-in-chief of the Sacramento Press. He joins us each Tuesday. David, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, you'll meet Sacramento High School students who recently won the National Science Bowl. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later this morning on Talk of the Nation, we return to Tunisia, where the Arab Spring began. How is life there today? Also, Chaz Bono on changing gender. The former Chastity Bono has made a documentary titled Becoming Chaz that will air soon on the Oprah Winfrey Network. That and more on Talk of the Nation starting at 11 here on Capital Public Radio. Well, last week, students at a Sacramento high school won a very prestigious competition, the National Science Bowl. Five students from Mira Loma High School were there, along with one of the school's teachers, who is a longtime coach of the team. And he joins us, James Hill. He's a chemistry and biology teacher at Mira Loma, along with Andrew Chen, who's a senior at Mira Loma and captain of the National Science Bowl team, and Sriram Penyala, who's also a senior, also been a member of the team for 4 years. Welcome all.
Thank you.
And congratulations, by the way, on winning the National Science Bowl.
Thank you.
Thank you.
James Hill, teacher, we'll start with you. This is your 12th time going there.
Yes.
What's the secret?
You have a wonderful group of students to work with, and they're highly motivated and dedicated, and they work really hard to achieve this goal. And that's one of the clues to success for the team.
Yeah. Well, Andrew and Sriram, you've both been members of this Mira Loma team for 4 years. So this is, for each of you, your fourth time going to the Nationals?
Yeah.
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 Andrew, why did you get involved in National Science Bowl?
My brother actually did the National Science Bowl when he was back in high school 4 years ago. And when he was a senior, I was an eighth grader, and I would actually join in on his practices. And I just thought, this is such a fun competition. Like, you know, it's like a Jeopardy-like competition. So when you know the answer, you ring in with a buzzer and they address you and you say the answer. So it's a lot more fun than your standard tests, your standard written test. So I thought, well, this seems like something I really want to do for like during high school. So I decided to join then.
And what about you, Sriram? What brought you to National Science Bowl?
You know, it's actually a funny story. It's serendipity, actually. So I was walked in one day to Mr. Hill's classroom. I was taking his class, honors chemistry. A lot of freshmen take it in Mira Loma. And I saw the Science Bowl and people doing science. Essentially, it's a Jeopardy-style competition, right? I thought it was really fun, but back then I didn't really know that much, and I tried out. It turned out I got made the B team, and Andrew was the captain of the B team back then. And it turns out that the A team couldn't even go to Nationals, so the B team went to Nationals. And we actually got second that year at the National Science Bowl, which is great. And so I definitely realized a lot of the interest in science, and then I studied a lot in that summer and the summers after that. And so now we're doing really well.
Well, James Hill, how do you choose who's going to be on the team? Because you probably get more people wanting to be on the team than can be on the team.
Exactly. What happens is in August when we come back to school, we have an organizational meeting, and anyone that's interested is eligible to compete on the team. And so we usually have 50, 60, 70 people who show up who will work our way down till we can actually form four teams. And normally we can take two teams to the regional competition, but we have a lot of interest in students, and that sort of keeps our program going. And so at the regional competition last year, we had three teams actually. And then, of course, the winning team goes to the national competition. So it promotes itself, and the students are really interested in Science Bowl.
Andrew, Sriram, are you both scientists yourselves at the high school level?
I'd say that we could probably both be considered scientists. Over the last summer, I did some research at UC Davis, just a little bit of stuff.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, but
what
were
you doing?
I worked on nanotechnology.
Nanotechnology.
So
those little tiny things will save the world.
Yeah, making these little devices that can sense chemical changes and
some
stuff.
Some people worry about that.
That it might take over the world.
Yeah.
But yeah,
or that they're just bad for the environment.
Okay.
Yeah. And what about you, Sriram?
I guess I could be considered a scientist. I mean, if you look at the Science Bowl, it's not very close to what scientists do, and scientists do research. But I also have done some research at UC Davis, at CSUS. But I think that it's what the Science Bowl promotes, which is really important, is interest in science among young people so they can become scientists later on. And so I think that's a really great thing.
James Hill, do you get any non-scientists who happen to be good at the National Science Bowl because they've just got such amazing general knowledge?
You have to have the science knowledge to do well in Science Bowl, because it's fact-based and deals with all the different areas of science. So that would go hand in hand to have an excellent recall and excellent memory, but they have to have knowledge of science.
So it touches on all the sciences?
Yes. Biology, chemistry, physics, earth and space, math, and what have I left out? Energy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. So does that mean you need everyone on the team to have broad general knowledge of science, or do you look for one person who specializes in biology, one in physics, and so on?
Exactly. What we try to do is we have specialists, and they specialize in one or two areas. For example, Sriram is our specialist, our expert in chemistry. Andrew is our expert in earth and space science. And we have certain ones in biology. And so we try to have all bases covered because you can have four people competing at a time.
What happens if the specialist doesn't know the answer to the question, but one of the others on the team does? Do you give him a hard time?
Well, I mean, we actually have two types of people in the National Science Bowl. If you look at our Captain Andrew, I mean, he's really driven our success for the last couple of years, I have to say. And so he, I would call a generalist. He knows a lot of stuff, not just in earth and space science, but also in different areas. So if there's a chemistry question that I didn't know the answer to particularly, he would probably have a pretty good guess of the answer. And so he would buzz in if I was not. I was not able to buzz in at that point.
Yeah.
Either way, it makes for some funny situations because sometimes you have inter-team, inside one team, you have multiple people trying to fight for the same thing, even though on the same team. So you have like one person trying to steal the biology person's question because he's like, I got it faster than you.
In the competition, though, anybody can buzz in.
Yeah. We're talking with members of the Mira Loma High School National Science Bowl winning team. Andrew Chen is the captain. Sriram Penjala is, along with Andrew, the longest serving member of the Mira Loma team. And James Hill is a chemistry and biology teacher at the school and the coach of the National Science Bowl team at Mira Loma High School. James, could you give us an example of the kind of questions that get asked, if you can remember any?
I think if you ask the boys, they can give you much more detailed questions.
Okay. What about you, Andrew?
One of the questions that I can remember off the top of my head is it was a quick, simple physics calculational question. So it said that the Secretary of Energy, Stephen Chu, he's riding a bicycle and he's riding it around this vertical loop. So it's kind of like a circus loop, right?
Okay.
And asked, how fast does he have to be going in order to stay on the loop while he's at the top of the loop so he doesn't fall off the loop?
Oh, my goodness.
He's going upside down around the loop. And it's really just a pretty simple calculation, though. I think for our team, it was pretty difficult because we're just so shocked by the fact that they would ask this type of question. Because normally it's like a very formal type of question. But
how do you answer that question? What do you have to do to answer that question?
So the calculation is you have to balance out the weight of gravity, so his mass, and you have to cancel that out with the centripetal force that you get by going really fast. So you know how if you make a quick turn, you feel like a force that's pushing you away or something. Well, same thing. If you're going very fast, there's going to be this centripetal force that pushes you into the loop and away from the ground.
And that's like that thing you can do sometimes at amusement parks where the thing rotates very fast
and
you stay up in the air.
Yeah.
So what was the answer? Do you remember?
The answer was, I think it was like 14. Either way, you had to just do a couple of quick calculations.
Very good. And Sriram, do you have another example of a question?
Yeah, I have an example of a chemistry question, actually. It was in the final round. We actually had two final rounds. We lost the first one and we won the second one. And because we were in the undefeated team going into double elimination at that point, we ended up winning the tournament. So the question was in the, I believe it was the aldol condensation reaction.
Whoa, you've lost me already, but continue.
It's a chemical reaction, organic chemistry. And so it was in the aldol condensation reaction. What functional group is formed by the deprotonation of a ketone?
Oh,
and so the
goodness.
Answer was an enolate. And so it's the kind of knowledge that Science Bowl tests is. There's some calculational questions, or there'll be some questions of applying like general chemistry knowledge, and there'll be some questions for just specific knowledge like that one. So,
well, I mean, that just the question alone just sounds funny to the average person. But I mean, even among science interested people, is that obscure?
Well, I mean, among people in high school usually don't take organic chemistry. But once you get into college, if you're going to be a pre-med or if you're going to be a chemistry major or a biology major, you're probably going to end up taking organic chemistry and learning something like that.
Yeah.
Well, for the calculation ones, I'm pretty sure most people in our school's physics class could have done the calculation I did. But the question is the time, because they only give you 20 seconds and you have to work as fast as you possibly can. This was a bonus question, so you work as a team. But still, many of the calculational questions, they're not an issue of difficulty, but more of how quickly and efficiently you can do them.
Now, you guys beat Montgomery Blair High School of Maryland, and looks like you killed them, 64-40.
I think...
I mean, I know you don't want to use that kind of terminology, but I mean, that's the way it looks to me.
I mean, it's a pretty close score.
Oh, really?
In my opinion, because each question can actually be worth a potential 14 points. So if it's only a difference of 24, then let's say we missed a question and they had gotten it instead, that's we lost another 14 points and they would gain another 14 and they would win. So I see. You think about it, it's only a one question win.
Well, if I'd analyzed the score more scientifically, I would have figured that out. Maybe.
But earlier in the competition, in some of the preliminary rounds, they would be, so they would sometimes have scores 202 to 18 and things like that. So they really trampled some of the other schools. So
it was a bit too close to be comfortable.
Yeah.
Well, James Hill, you're losing at least two team members because Andrew and Sriram are both seniors. How are you going to replace them?
I'm losing four of the members. Four of them are seniors. So we have one of the students who our alternate was a sophomore. So he'll be returning. So it's basically a rebuilding year.
Do you expect to be going back for a 13th time next year?
Well, I would hope so, but you never know until the regional competition. But you know, we have again a lot of great students to pull from and a lot of interest. So I certainly hope that we can continue to compete.
You're going to be going to Australia.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Tell us about that.
We actually went 2 years ago, too. It was the same trip that they gave the winning team. So Australia trip, it's an event known as International Science School, and they have a bunch of famous lecturers from around the world come to the University of Sydney, and then you are one of 150 students that get to listen to the lectures. And there's also workshops and seminars, and it's a really great experience. You get to learn a lot of science, a lot of how science works in the real world. And I really can't wait.
And that's this summer?
Yeah, this summer.
Well, winter in Australian time.
Right, exactly.
Summer here. And Sriram, what are your plans when you leave Mira Loma?
Right now I'm planning to go to Harvard, and I'm thinking of majoring in chemistry and also economics. I hope in the future, probably in the far future, to start an entrepreneurial venture, possibly working on America's energy problem or something else like that, or biotechnology. But that's definitely a long time from now. Right now I'm just want to go to Harvard and do well there.
Yeah, I'm sure you will. And what about you, Andrew?
I'm thinking of going to MIT, and my list major is bioengineering, but I'm not sure whether I might add maybe astronomy or something like that onto there. For my career plans, I'm not really sure yet. I might go into the bioengineering businesses, like biomedical and that sort of stuff, or I might decide just be a doctor or something.
Well, good luck to you both. I'm sure you'll do well, and congratulations to you and the other team members at Mira Loma High School, who recently won the National Science Bowl. And James Hill, teacher at Mira Loma and coach of the team, thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting us.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, award-winning Mexican folk dancer Stephen Valencia. You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. On tomorrow's show, a documentary about local bicycle artisan Steve Rex, also photojournalist Jose Luis Villegas, and pictures of blues legends he's taken over the last 20 years, plus the annual improvisational music festival In the Flow. A Sacramento dancer who specializes in Mexican folkloric culture recently won a very prestigious award. He was one of the winners of the Maestro's Award from the Latino Arts Network of California. He's Stephen Valencia and is artistic director of Compañía Mazatlán Bellas Artes, which has a couple of performances coming up in our area in the next couple of weeks, specifically in Folsom this weekend and Stockton the weekend after. Right now we're going to talk with Stephen Valencia. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
How did you get started doing Mexican folkloric dance?
Well, actually, I started in an in-school arts program in elementary school as a kid. And one of the programs at the elementary school that helps keep kids busy and learning about their culture. I'm actually a fourth-generation American. My great-grandparents on both sides came from Mexico in their teens during the revolutionary years. So we were sort of disconnected from our culture growing up. So my parents thought it was important for me to learn about our culture, so got me involved in dance through Folklorico in elementary school, and I never stopped from there.
Did you do other kinds of dance as well, or did you get into Mexican dance right away?
Mostly Mexican dance, but I've studied and I've trained in classical ballet and contemporary modern dance.
Now, your company, the company you direct includes the name Mazatlán. Does that mean all the music and all the dance is from that state?
No. Actually, Mazatlán is a beach resort city in Sinaloa, which actually, from the 12 years I've been there, this is the first year we're going to be doing pieces from Sinaloa.
Oh.
So actually, we don't do anything. It actually has a funny story about how the company gained its name. It was from our executive director's restaurant. It was called Mazatlan years and years ago.
Okay. Well, we've got an example of some of the kind of music that your company dances to. Let's listen to a bit of it first. Called Las Amarillas, and where's that from?
That's from the state of Guerrero.
Yeah. Can you tell us how you would approach a dance to a song like that? Are there standard steps that you must follow, or is it something that you create afresh every time?
Well, every region in Mexico, there's 32 states in Mexico, and every state has its own form of dance, its own kind of its own culture. And then even within the state, it's regional. So different regions might have their own different style of costume, music. It's part of the folk culture. So there is a basic guideline you have to follow when you're putting pieces together. They may be something that we learned from an instructor from Mexico. I've taken classes, and maybe something I might bring back. Oftentimes, the difference with our company is we're very innovative. We create pieces. I bring in a lot of guest choreographers, some of the largest from the largest institutions in Mexico, and we'll collaborate and putting pieces together. So we will use the essence of the technique from that region and kind of create new pieces too.
Could get kind of expensive if you got a large group of dancers with all these costumes and perhaps large bands, large groups of musicians.
Yeah, definitely. We have very expensive. Costuming, we have over 26 dancers in the company. So we work with usually about 10 couples. So you're talking about 20 dancers on stage at one time. Like I said, some of the states may have different regions within them. So you might have costume changes within one piece. So we may do two costume changes in one region itself.
My guest is the dancer Stephen Valencia. What's your role when the Compañía Mazatlán Bellas Artes is performing? Are you dancing as well on stage, or are you directing from the wings?
I get to yell all the time.
Okay.
No, I don't. Right now we're fortunate enough to have quite a few dancers, so I don't dance if I don't have to. So when it's more important for me to be backstage or in the booth running the technical aspects of the shows, because there's a lot of aspects in regards to this live music. We have a lot of lighting patterns, so it's not a basic show. There's a whole lot that goes to it, so I have to be around with the technicians and the backstage, front stage managers, and kind of running the show.
You last month received the Maestro Award from the Latino Arts Network of California. Very prestigious. Did they say exactly what it was you'd done to merit the award?
It was work that I've done in the community. We have done quite a bit in our community in regards to creating in-school arts programs, creating programs that focus on at-risk youth in our community, bringing just our culture to the forefront, being able to present in theaters like the Three Stages and Folsom or some of the places we've been in the past. I think that they recognize some of the work that I've done.
But a lot of these arts programs have been eliminated or at least severely reduced because of budget problems. How does your company fit into that situation?
We work closely with the districts. We're working close with Twin Rivers School District, creating budgets that they can pay for in regards to just being able to get the programs in the schools without being too much of a cost to the districts, and the parents are getting involved in trying to do fundraisers and things like that. So it's a lot of community work. We work together with families, community members, We have a lot of great sponsors. Wells Fargo has been one of the sponsors that has definitely helped us the most. The state, California Arts Council, the Sacramento Metropolitan Arts Commission has been integral in funding our program. So we've been fortunate.
Now, when you teach dance to at-risk youth in this gang violence reduction project that I read about, how do those young people react when you say, well, let's put on our costumes and do folk dance?
That was one of the programs I started with originally back in 1998, I believe, 1999. That program no longer exists. But it was a program created by a counseling center and Sacramento probation in a high school. So it was kind of an idea to kind of create different programs the kids can get involved with as opposed to getting into gangs. They took very well to it. A lot of the kids, once they try it once or twice, they tend to really like it. So,
but were they skeptical at first?
They're always skeptical. what's going on here? Different music, different sounds, different kinds of movements. So, but once they get into it, they tend to like it. Actually, I always say that one of my favorite classes that I ever taught was actually at Juvenile Hall in Santa Clara. I taught in the girls' section of Juvenile Hall, and those kids just really, really loved to dance. They loved the attention and music, so it was fantastic.
Dancer Stephen Valencia, he and his compañía Mazatlán Bellas Artes are doing two dance shows in the next couple of weeks. Sunday, May 15th at 3 p.m. at Three Stages at Folsom Lake College. And the Sunday after, that's May 22nd, also at 3 p.m. at the Bob Hope Theater in Stockton. Stephen Valencia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, we'll talk with folk country Celtic guitarist Kathy Barwick and her new album, In My Life. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callis, and later today on Capital Public Radio News, what businesses in the Sierra think about the upcoming temporary closure of Highway 50 at Echo Summit to fix and improve safety walls. That and more during All Things Considered. Folk, country, Celtic guitarist and singer Kathy Barwick has a new album. It's her first solo album. It's called In My Life, and it includes Celtic, bluegrass, country blues, and a certain well-known Beatles song. We'll talk with Kathy Barwick in a minute, but first, here's the first song on her new album. It's called Nashville Blues. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I should say welcome back. You've been here before, but as a member of a group, Nine-Eighths Irish.
That's right.
Yeah, which of course plays Irish music and other kinds of Celtic music. But in this album, you play quite a wide variety of roots music of various kinds, including Irish music. But this one is an Earl Scruggs song.
It is an Earl Scruggs song, Nashville Blues. I used to be a full-time banjo player, and I used to make my living teaching banjo lessons. And banjo playing, and Earl Scruggs in particular, really informs all of my music, especially on guitar.
Yeah, and so you were playing guitar in that track,
but
it has a banjo sound to it, the song.
Yeah, I approach the guitar as if it was a banjo. There are three strings on the guitar that are same as three on the banjo, and I'll stick to those as much as I can.
But otherwise, do you have to change the way you play the guitar if you're playing in a banjo style?
Well, there are some changes that need to be made to accommodate the different tuning, and I will occasionally move to some of the other strings as well. But the big trick to that is something called cross-picking. And when you cross-pick the guitar, instead of playing a line up and down the neck, your right hand plays across the strings. And it's very much like a banjo roll. And so that's how it happens. And what you end up with is a unit of three in a pattern over a time of four. That's the secret of Earl Scruggs-style banjo playing. It syncopates the melody, and it does so by using that technique.
And it's got a very infectious sound. Now, you've been playing various kinds of music for more than 30 years. So what took so long to come up with your first solo album?
Well, I have some notes in my desk from 20 years ago, lists of things that I was going to put on the record. And I've tried a few times to get going on it. And what happened was I did a session at a studio here in Sacramento with Marty Cohen and the Sidekicks. And I really liked the engineer in the studio. And so when 9/8 Irish recorded their record, I suggested we use that studio. And when we got done with that, I booked another session and started working on this. So and, I'll just tell you, Craig Long, engineer at Paradise, he's just amazing.
Now, quite a few of the songs on the album In My Life are, is you solo, but there are a lot of guest artists on them, and it's often a different guest artist or artists on each song. I mean, just logistically, doing this recording must have been complicated.
Well, most of the musicians are here in Sacramento. There were a couple of them. Roland White, who is the brother of Clarence White, who is one of my idols on the guitar, recorded his tracks in Nashville. And John Reichman up in British Columbia, he recorded in a studio in Vancouver. And with the internet these days, you can upload those files in the correct format and download them on the other side and then work on integrating them into the piece.
Let's listen to another song from Kathy Barwick's new album, In My Life. This features Kathy singing, It's My Native Home.
I'd like to see my native home, the lofty trees, the golden sand, the rugged mountains crowded round my mother's voice, how sweet the sound. Often dream of home and friends. My dream.
You're singing with someone else. Who is it?
That's Samantha Olson. She is a local musician here. She plays the fiddle, mostly bluegrass these days, but she used to play rock and roll. So she brings a really wonderful blues influence to her singing and her fiddle playing.
Yeah, and there's such a familiarity. It sounds like a familiarity between the two of you on this song.
We have been playing music together for quite a while. Samantha works in the same office building that I do. We both work for Cal EPA. And so we've had opportunities to play some music at work, and we formed a good friendship out of that.
Play music at work? You mean as part of some festivity, or do you stand in the stairwell and do it there?
There's a group of us that play generally on Tuesdays at lunchtime out on the right in front of the building when the weather's nice, and it's Irish music, and it's there that I first learned how to play some Irish tunes.
Yeah. Well, you play so many kinds of music. Is there one that you gravitate towards that is your musical home?
Well, I think bluegrass might be that. You know, the instrument that I really learned, one of the reasons I've got the banjo in my head so much, and the dobro, by the way, is tuned very similarly to a banjo as well, is because the banjo neck is the neck that I learned, even though I had played piano and guitar before that. So that kind of, it's my musical home, banjo and bluegrass. I will say I'm very enamored of Irish music these days, and I spend a lot of time at home just learning tunes because I like them.
Kathy Barwick, she's a multi-instrumentalist and singer, and her new album is called In My Life. Let's listen to another song, which to me has almost a Western swing sound to it. It's Florida Blues. Not smile when listening to that. Who are you playing with in this one?
Well, the fiddle player is Bruce Johnson, and he lives up in Colfax, and he's played in a number of really great bluegrass bands around California and the nation. And that is Roland White there on the mandolin. I sent a copy of the track via MP3 file, and he went into his studio and cut his mandolin work.
That's
there.
That's great. Now, we mentioned earlier that you play in several groups, one of which is 9/8 Irish, which was an insight a few months ago. You also play in a bluegrass band. Who's that?
I play with Mountain Laurel Bluegrass Band. They're based up in Grass Valley in Nevada City. And they've been together for 21 years or so. I've been in the band maybe 8 or 9.
And you play dobro in that band?
I do.
You play guitar in 9/8 Irish?
That's right.
And you play dobro in another group?
Yeah, the Mike Justice Band, which Mike is a really great singer-songwriter. And we do mostly his material, although we do some classic blues, old-time country blues, and some country rockish kind of stuff. And I play the dobro with them. Every now and then I pull out a lap steel. Steve McLean plays guitar, and sometimes I have to pull out a steel just to keep up with him.
This must keep you really busy, just keeping involved and up to speed with all these bands.
It does, and I'm very grateful to be able to play in all the bands because I do have very eclectic musical tastes. And so I really get something different out of each of the bands that I play with.
We're just about out of time. Let's make a few seconds space for another song from the album, Tell Me Why. Wasn't Tell Me Why. It's actually a beautiful song called
Josephine Swalt.
Very nice. So that's you playing solo?
That is. And yeah. That's one of the cuts that I play all the instruments on. It's bass, guitar, and dobro.
Yeah. Well, that's beautiful. It's a really nice album. It's called In My Life. And the person who made it is Kathy Barwick. She's been playing music for many years, but this is her first solo album. Kathy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers, Lynn Weaver, Liz Cazara, Sosin Marar, and Christine Guerra. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We'll be back tomorrow. We'll go out with some more music from In My Life. High school students have made a documentary about Sacramento bike frame builder Steve Rex. On the next Insight, we'll hear about the film. Plus, photojournalist Jose Luis Villegas opens an exhibit of his work documenting the greatest blues musicians of our time. And Sacramento's eclectic improvisational music festival returns for a fourth year. We'll talk with Ross Hammond about In the Flow. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.